Hey yo, and here we go, another episode of We Talk Music on the Air and in your ear, and I am the Crown Prince of Charisma, Mo, joined by the King of the Casters, Mr. Brett Podcast. Brett, are you excited?
I am excited. I can feel something. It's the shake. That's what I'm feeling. I'm feeling the shake.
You could feel the shake. Nice. Nicely done. I am also excited because we have founding member and rhythm guitarist at Jet Boy, Billy Rowe, joining us today. Hello, Billy.
Hey, how you guys doing?
Oh, good. We're great.
Great. We have about a million and one questions here, so we're going to jump right into them.
Well, I guess we'll be doing this for about a week.
Don't tempt us. Don't tempt us.
If he's up for it, I am.
Yeah, all right, man. Get some coffee.
Awesome. Well, the reason that we're here, I mean, right now, is to talk about the new album, Born to Fly. So it just came out on the 25th of January. So Frontiers got in touch with you in 2017, was it? And then here we are, early 2019, and you had the new album after 20 years. Like, that's pretty awesome.
28.
Yeah, 28, or if we want to count. Yeah, but let's say 28, because it'll be 29 by the end of this year. So.
Wow.
Yeah. So I might as well just say 30, but, you know.
Sure. 20 plus almost 30. An extended time away.
28 years. But, 28 years since the last full-length album. So this is our third full-length. So we took longer than Def Leppard to do my stereo.
Sorry. I'm sorry about that. My damn dog came by, knocked something off the table.
I figure the foundation was shaking. So
yeah, that's right. So, there you go. She doesn't know she's stupid. She doesn't know. I love her anyways. No comment to that. Yeah.
Love dogs.
Exactly. So, So here you are after the new album out. A lot of people are actually saying this is your best album. You got Album of the Week from LA Weekly. The reviews are great. Do you guys think this is your best album?
I guess we were saying that when we got finished with it, you know, telling people, I think, you know, and ourselves to each other that, you know, I think this is the best work we've ever done. And then we'd always end it with, well, you know, doesn't everybody say that when they do the new record? But, you know, I honestly really do feel it. I mean, and so does, you know, Mick and Fern. Feel the Shake is great, first record. And then second record, Damnation's great as well. But, you know, some of my favorite bands, I think it was by the third album, was when they went and really started to kick in the gear. You know, Aerosmith, The Toys in the Attic, and, you know, in a lot of ways, Kiss, Destroyer, you know, hardcore fans can, I'm sure, argue all that stuff, but I'm a fan of all that. You know, Cheap Trick, Heaven Tonight, I name those ones because those are like my all-time favorites. And all those bands, you know, in the 70s, you know, they developed on by the third album. They were, you know, kind of found themselves in a lot of ways, you know. And I feel that way with us as well.
Yeah, it just happened to take a few extra years in between, but hey, at least you're doing it, and you did find yourself. I mean, I think it's a really good album, and so I'm interested because there's the whole concept, like, you seem to be gaining fans and like gaining popularity again, and my question is, like, do you think it's the fact that even though you were in that glam zone, you were never necessarily a part of like the Poisons and that kind of thing?
I think, you know, back then we were all friends, and we were all those bands were, you know, super supportive of each other. We were friends, hung out at the club, the party together, and blah blah blah. But Jet Boy always kind of stood, you know, not only because we were from San Francisco, but, you know, singing with a mohawk, it was always a little bit something different with the band than the rest. And yeah, maybe in a lot of ways, that's, you know, why we're here now, you know. Maybe we're ahead of ourselves for its time, or I don't know. But we always kind of claimed to be just real stripped down rock and roll band, and really not try to pigeonhole ourselves as a glam band or a punk band or whatever. Just kind of just a straightforward,
yeah, you can certainly
rock and roll band.
Certainly see the look there, you know, I mean, you had big hair and everything, you know, and leather and that type of thing. You know, you had the look, but the sound was always, I mean, Mickey Finn's voice is always, you know, had a bit more grit to it than your typical metal singer at the time, and not that high-pitched scream, you know. It was, like you say, it's really more real basic, good, straight, regular rock and roll that, you know, with a bit of a punk and blues edge.
Yeah, that's pretty much what we were, you know, and doing this new record, we just said to each other, it's like, well, we're just going to do what we feel would be the next, you know, our third Jetboy record. You know, we didn't really think of it like, oh, let's write like it'd be the third record. We just kind of wrote a record as, you know, a Jetboy record, what we felt would be the next Jetboy record. And this is what we came up with. And I think it's, you know, we didn't try to reinvent anything. We just kind of wrote songs like we did before. And just, I think just where we're at now as musicians, we've all grown and gotten better at what we do individually, with what we do in the band, and it's showing on this record.
So how did the writing process change then from, say, a 1990 and Damned Nation to now with, you know, it writing in 2017, 2018?
Right. You know, the band's gone through several, you know, writing, different writing ways, because in the early days, Fern and I would write riffs, and then we'd piece them together, and Mick would write the vocals and melodies to it. You know, going into the first record and second record, we sat down with a couple outside writers, and there was a little different approach of, like, you know, bouncing off of the people you don't really know very well, you know. But on this record, we pretty much did it the same, but yet we did it different in a lot of ways. And one is because our singer lives farther away than Fern and I. So Fern and I were able to get together face to face and work on stuff, and then we would just send it to Mick and he would write to it. For myself, I really got into recording, you know, Logic, Pro Tools, like, you know, I'm a Logic guy, but it's the same as like Pro Tools. So I got really into recording. So I was able to write songs that were complete all the way down to like all the drum parts on this record, all of them I wrote. And then send them to Mick, and he would write his ideas, and boom, he'd have them down. And then we demoed everything, every single song for this album. We demoed complete with as much as we knew we wanted to have on the record, down to all the harmonies, the shakers, the, you know, the girl backing vocals and everything. And then, so when we went into the studio to record this album, we knew exactly what we wanted to do and how we were going to do it. So that was a lot different in a lot of ways when it comes to recording albums, because, you know, we went in with producers and, you know, they put their twist on directing us and helping us with, you know, getting the song down and making it as best as possible. But this time we did all of that along with the producer, Luke Tierney. So it was so fun making this record.
That's great. I mean, you know, one of the things that gets me about this record and why I think it's so strong is the music has always been good, and the music is still good, but lyrically, obviously, after, you know, so many more years of life experience, it's more mature and more, I just think it's had a step up.
Yeah, I totally agree. I didn't write the lyrics. That's all Mick's always been the one with the lyrics and the melodies of the songs, and just, that's exactly it, just like you said. Through all these years of his life experiences, what his ups and downs and ins and outs and zigs and zags is what came out of this record, you know, vocally and, I mean, lyrically. So it's pretty awesome, you know. He did a great job.
Was there any time pressure put on you by Frontiers to get the album out for a certain time, or were you just kind of given, you know, free rein to, you know, get the best record that you could get?
Free reign of total creative control of the record, but they did give us a deadline, because deadlines, you know, with a lot of bands, they'll take forever to do a record and they want to get it out. So, and deadlines for us to have a target date creates pressure, and I think pressure is real good for creativity and rock and roll. So they did give us a deadline, and we pretty much met the deadline, you know. We got it done and sent them everything before the mixes and go, like, we're almost done. We got it all done recorded, but we're going through a couple mixes. So we might have slipped into a little bit over the deadline, but nothing major by, you know, like 6 months or anything, maybe a few weeks or a month. So.
And I guess, so how long ago was the album finished versus the time that it was released?
Finished in, well, we got the deal in 2017, and we recorded it in 2017, But it really, we didn't, you know, that was, we recorded it towards the end of the year of 2017. I think it was like November was, I believe, of 2017, we were supposed to deliver it. But I don't think we really technically delivered it till maybe January of 2018. And then we got into the artwork and, you know, there was an earlier target date of 2018. And for whatever reason, they said, you know what, let's make this an early 2019 release. So I don't know. I look at it as like, well, things happen for a reason. So I'm not going to try to figure out why that happened, but.
Yeah. And really, as long as it gets released, that's the important thing, right?
Yeah. You know, I look at it, it's like, we're doing the Monsters of Rock cruise coming up. It's the first one we've ever done. I know that's a big high profile thing. So, the album will be out a month by the time we do that. So I'm looking at it as like, well, that's kind of perfect timing for something like that. So a lot of records are coming out this year, you know, and like a few bands are, you know, new Michael Monroe's coming out, Buck Cherry and Back to Your Babies. And so it's probably a better time because there's going to be more opportunities to maybe get on some of these, you know, team up with some of these bands and tour.
Yeah, for
sure. Are these some of the people I'm guessing that you just, you hung with before and you haven't seen in a while and you'd love to see again?
That, are there any?
No, those bands you mentioned.
I love those bands. I think they're great. You know, our old bass player, Sammy, plays with Michael Monroe, and the rest of the guys are all our friends. And so it's really, yeah, it'd be great. You know, yeah, they're all friends. So it'd be definitely fun as hell to do some touring with them.
So you mentioned the artwork, and I think the album cover is extremely cool. It's pretty simple, but to me, that really just captures the band's personality. Mm-hmm. So how did that come about?
Yeah, with the artwork, we were kicking around ideas, and that could be harder than writing a record. You know, you're talking about a bunch of, you know, a bunch of panels and the CD, and, you know, now vinyl again, which is great. And it was in the back of my mind to do something simple, you know, and Mick just kind of said, why don't we just do a black cover? And I'm like, dude, that's exactly what I was thinking. Let's just do something simple. And then we go like, you know, I think I threw it out there. It's like, let's do like, it's an old distressed album cover, you know, that's just like beat to hell. And that's what we went with. And I think it's great. You know, it's like just no bullshit, just straightforward, you know, let the music do the talking.
No, it's awesome. I love it. I think it's great. You know, all of it, the Born to Fly, you know, the band's logo, everything just looks great. And on the black cover, it pops, right? Everything pops that's supposed to pop. And that's what makes mm-hmm. it look cool.
Right. Yep. I agree.
So then you've got the music video as well, which I also think is a really nice music video. Like, I think it's really well done. From a technical perspective, you know?
Right. The Born to Fly video?
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, we, you know, for the first video, we all agreed that, you know, once we knew we were going to call the album Born to Fly, that's going to be the first song to release. And, you know, the band and the label really kind of picked the same songs to release first as singles and videos, which is pretty cool. You know, we all kind of kicked it, all have our own ideas and stuff. And they said, you guys pick what you like, and we'll pick what we like, and we'll come to a happy medium. Well, the happy medium was we picked the same ones. So, and we just, you know, Born to Fly, we just wanted to introduce the band again as a live thing and just do a performance video.
So how different is that to have that kind of support you know, creative freedom? Was that something you guys were afforded in your first two albums, or was it just a completely different experience back then?
I can't say there's no creative freedom, but you got everybody. And, you know, it was a whole different time back then. Radio and MTV and, you know, sales and Billboard charts and charting and all that. So it was, things were looked at way different because it was all about getting on the radio and selling records and being as big as you can, you know, because you're on a major label and you got big management. So there was a lot of hands in the pot back then. But this time around, it's not. It's a lot easier. But then the whole industry's different. So, you know, just kind of, you know, how it is. It was definitely a lot easier to do this record because we had complete freedom to nobody coming in going, oh, move that chorus to here and shorten that. So, which can be kind of irritating when it's a guy in a suit, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah, no kidding.
So when it comes to touring, like you said, you're going out on the Monsters of Rock. Like, how much of the new stuff do you think you'll do on that on the cruise? And then also, well, do you know how many shows you're doing on the cruise?
Two performances on the cruise, from what I understand.
Oh yeah.
So, yeah.
And then how many new songs will you do?
A spot full of shows already. We've already done four shows since New Year's. We did the 30th, 31st, New Year's Eve with Junkyard up in the Bay Area in Fresno. And then we just played this previous weekend, which was NAMM weekend. We did Huntington Beach and the Viper Room in Hollywood. And we've been playing at least four songs from the new record.
How easy is it then for you guys to tour? Like, I don't know. Like, do you have jobs or is Jet Boy right now kind of the main thing?
Have jobs and live in the reality world on planet Earth here. But we're gonna do what we can do. I think that goes for anybody these days. It's just even some of these bands that are a lot bigger, there's still a lot of shuffling around personal lives you got to do with people that have kids now and families and other businesses. So we're gonna do we're just we're just gonna take it as it comes. We're gonna work on trying to get on some stuff and put some maybe a package thing together, but we're not gonna do anything that doesn't make sense. It's gonna make sense and be the right thing to do. And so we'll see how it pans out. I look at it as like I just kind of said to everyone, I said, let's just let the album dictate what's gonna happen for us.
So your day job, is that rock and roll relics and guitar making and that type of thing? Designs and
That's my yeah, it's my guitar company. I basically started this company and I have a brand now and like 10 different models and I have dealers all over the world and that keeps me busy as hell. It's nonstop for me, but that doesn't mean I can get away. I can't get away and do some dates because I got people who work for me too. So,
So what then makes it, do you have like a theory on what makes a perfectly good guitar?
not really. I just kind of what I do with my stuff is kind of throwback of vintage style stuff with modern twists and just more of a consistency of they all have that feel. They all feel and play great like they've been made for you. That's my whole thing is they feel worn in and not stiff and new and like a new pair of stiff shoes or something. So I don't have any magic fairy dust or anything. I really just kind of at the end set up a guitar what feels good in my hands and yeah, a lot of people seem to love them, so it's great.
So how does that come about? Did you kind of were you unhappy with the guitars you were playing, or were you just looking to explore something new creatively or something else?
Well, no, I'm a total guitar geek. I love guitars, and I built a guitar in high school. I was very into people. I was probably inspired being a Van Halen fan, knowing that Eddie Van Halen used to put parts guitars together and paint them and come up with his iconic designs as they are now. And there's a lot of other guys who would do that. In the 70s is when all these pickups and pedals and different tuners and bridges and stuff started coming out to make a guitar play better and be more just in tune and be able to intonate better and et cetera. So through the years I always was into just vintage guitars as they are now. They were kind of just used. They were just used then. But I got to a point where I just, I've always put together like parts guitars and tweaked on stuff through my guitars through the years. And with the internet, I just saw this thing starting with these aged relic guitars. People were building guitars and making them look old. And that's totally up my alley. I love the look of an old beat up guitar. And so I started building a few and sold a couple on eBay. And I just like going, oh, you know what? I see couple other of these guys building websites selling guitars like this, and maybe I'll give it a shot. And a few years later I started to create this buzz and then it just started to take off. And now I got people like Billy Joe playing my stuff and we just did NAMM and Richard Fortus wants to get something and it's good. I got these cool hotshot rock guys. I'm doing some work on one of Paul Stanley's personal guitars, and I'm really
that's
into the
be
aging.
A, that's got to be a like thrill.
Oh yeah, it's amazing. You know, absolutely incredible. And I do this aging to guitars, and I'm one of those guys out there who's known as one of the best ones who could do it. So, you know, it's cool.
So how does it, you know, and compare then, you know, when you've created a guitar and you've completed the design, compared to when you've created a song and completed that and it's finished?
Yeah, it's a creative outlet and a creative approach, you know. It's just one's strumming the guitar and finding the right chords and catchy riffs and melodies to put on top of it. And the other is just, I look at the guitar and I like, I know vintage guitars and how they wear out and the spots. But I also take it to another level of where it's more of an artistic approach. And I just kind of like approach it how what I think is going to look cool and someone's going to be wowed by it. So it's kind of the same approach. It's just two different things.
Do you ever have a problem kind of knowing when it's done? Like, do you ever have that, like, oh, I want to keep doing this and maybe add some more? Or is there a moment where you're kind of like, nope, this is exactly how I wanted it to be?
Yeah, it could go both ways for sure. You know, there's a lot of times because I love doing it. So a lot of times I could keep on going, but sometimes I just got to look and go, you know what? I think I'm there. It looks great.
How long does it take
you
to do?
Same with a song.
Yeah.
Same with a song. Yeah.
How long does it take you to do a guitar?
You know, really, if I really added up the hours of the painting and the work, it's probably not that many hours if you just scrunched it all together. But you're talking about spreading stuff out of painting a guitar, which takes, you know, I can, you know, from the type of finishing I do, all this nitrocellulose lacquer, probably like I can finish the guitar, the finish work in like 3 or 4 days. But then you got to let it cure for a week and, and then start working on it. But with me right now, I'm not just working on new guitars. We have, you know, sometimes up to 70 guitars that are in the works, you know, some going out, some getting started. So some in the middle, some just getting painted, some getting aged. So
yeah, you got a whole crew working with you then.
Yeah. I don't have a big crew. I got a guy full time and a couple guys coming in on part time to help out with sanding and painting. But, I'm working on that now because I just relocated back down to Los Angeles, and a big part of it is a bigger location and being able to find people who know how to do this kind of work. I definitely will need to hire a couple more people soon.
You know, I think it's the website's really cool. You know, obviously, you have the instruments on there, and some of them are just like they're just awesome. I like the Johnny Thunder's Chinese Rocks model. That's my favorite of the ones when I was going through it today.
Right,
I just think it's really it's really cool stuff. And hopefully I think the listeners here should be listening to Jet Boy and going to that website at the same time, checking it out.
Yeah, for sure. Cool. That's awesome.
So I'm interested, you know, like one of the things we always like to talk about is for the folks that we know who were around in the early days of the Sunset Strip. Do you have any good stories from the Sunset Strip?
Oh, that's a little open-ended, but yeah,
yeah,
go ahead.
All of them. I'll take all of them right now.
There's all kinds of stories. It just depends where you want to go with it. You know, there's, you know, it was the era of sex, drugs, and rock and roll. So there's a ton of stories. I mean, my stories aren't all about just the Sunset Strip. I mean, we were playing, you know, we were like, you know, attached at the hip at one point with Guns N' Roses. So there was a lot of just hanging out and just being fans of the stuff that we were all into at the time and just sharing that same love for the bands that influenced us, you know, and doing shows together, you know, and us, you know, GNR and Jet Boy playing with Johnny Thunders one night and just completely in awe because we love Johnny Thunders and, you know, doing shows with Lords of the New Church and then heard some stuff, but you know, the Sunset Strip, it was like, you know, there was a lot of partying. There was a lot of, you know, being in packed clubs with, you know, big rock and roll teased hair and big boobs and the whole thing, you know, and drugs and booze and that's all that shit everywhere. It was, you know, it was an insane time, but you know, you're just living in the moment, you know? So, I think for me, a lot of things that weren't, it wasn't even, it was when we moved to LA was running into heroes or people, you know, that influenced me or I was a fan of, like Brian Setzer, you know, and you know, when I saw him sitting in and knowing who the band was and goes, you know, I'm asking him, hey, you want to do a song with us? And next thing he's jamming Folsom Prison Blues with us. And, you know, we met with Paul Stanley. He was interested in producing the first Jet Boy record and him coming to rehearsal and watching a few songs. That kind of stuff was some of the real highlights for me personally over any of the other stuff of just hanging out in the club, you know, because everybody was friends and kind of, we're all on the same level at that point.
Now, was there ever, oh,
go ahead, Brett.
I'm wondering if there was ever kind of a moment where you realized that Jet Boy had that, like, you know, you guys were a group together and it was just, you knew that you had locked in that group mentality kind of thing.
For sure. I mean, we went through, you know, and when we were starting to pack the clubs, it was, you know, it was us, Guns N' Roses, LA Guns, Faster Pussycat, and Poison. Those were the five bands that really launched that next generation after Motley Crue, Rat, and, you know, those bands that went massive and became household names. So, yeah, I mean, it was like, I think we all got to a point when we had labels looking at us and all that we got to this point where we, you know, we really just started to click and go, we knew what we were doing and each band became their own thing and had that identity and the brand started to become the brand of the band, of the names, you know, like Jet Boy, like the bands I mentioned. And I think when we did the records is when, you know, for me personally, and I could probably say for the rest of the guys, is when we really musically came together and really just went to another level. You know, you're working with a big producer and, you know, and also Sam Yaffa, when he joined the band, I think that was like a huge, just huge injection into us of just this guy who was a phenomenal bass player, but had already done everything we were about to do. And, you know, times 10 probably at that point. So, that's, you know, yeah, he just, you know, Sam really did a lot for the band back then by just his experience, what he had done with Hanoi Rocks. So,
no, I think
long-winded answer for that, but you know,
no, it's awesome. Like we're fascinated by this stuff, you know, and, one of the things that is that the Sunset Strip, I mean, for those of us, I mean, never quite got a chance to experience it. I mean, I was a teenager, but just a couple years too young to get down there. And, you know, I feel like it's just kind of important to document and some of these memories. And so it kind of, could you tell me about some of the iconic locations, some of the iconic, you know, venues and different places that were very important and what made them special in that era in the Sunset Strip?
So are those you're saying, or?
Pardon me?
The special ones you're saying? Well, for us back then, I think our first show was at the Roxy on the Sunset Strip, which is of course an iconic club. I probably didn't really put it all together till a little bit later on, you know, that's where like the Rocky Horror Picture Show first was, the play was when it came to America, and some of my favorite bands like the Babies and all these bands, you know, would play this iconic club back in the day when they first came to Los Angeles. And then, you know, the next club we played was the Troubadour, which, I mean, everybody was playing the Troubadour back in the day in the 70s, Elton John and, you know, Linda Ronstadt and all that stuff. So that was the iconic part of that. And then of course the Whiskey a Go-Go, you know, I look at it now and, you know, we played all those clubs quite a few times back in the day. And it's more now that I look back and go like, wow, we were like, we had our own part of a generation of music, of bands that became humongous, that played those very same clubs years later after some of these bands that I used to sit home as a kid and listen to, you know, be cool.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, it's such an interesting time period, and I mean, in its own way, obviously, it can never really come back. It is, and I mean, I don't know. We haven't been down to the Sunset Strip in a while. Is there? What's the music scene like there? Do you even know?
Yeah, because I live down here again, so I do go there. There, you go to the Whiskey when these, bands from that era play, and it's not the same, but it's the same. It's like there's people there that are into it. It's just different times. It's just, I think in LA, there's a lot of rock and roll that's still alive and well, and it's great, The Roxy, and you walk in the Rainbow, and you just get swallowed with rock and roll and metal and all that. I mean, that's just how it is. So there's still definitely a good energy for it down in LA. As how it was before, it's like, well, before, when all that was happening through those years, that was just what was happening. And I guess it'll never come back again, but. Yeah, that's just kind of how things work. I guess just like the 70s, and when I was a kid, the 70s New York scene of the CBGBs and Max's Kansas City, that'll never come back. It's just things change. But that's also kind of it not coming back, or it continuing, or a new thing like that happening is kind of what makes it so great, because it won't come back. Is why it's so cherished in a lot of ways, if that makes any sense.
Yeah,
Oh yeah,
absolutely.
for sure.
Absolutely.
Now, do you think there is a fairly big collection of people that are still into the music and the Sunset Strip and that whole, part of history?
Oh yeah, for sure. I think so. I mean, I went to see our buddies Kix a couple weeks ago. It was the end of December. And it was packed, and they just slayed the room, and it was just awesome. I mean, the energy was there, everything, the fans, the band, it was amazing. So it's there for sure.
Do you think maybe that it's even a little bit more fun now that there maybe isn't some of the pressure of, trying to be a rock star and trying to, sell 2 million albums and that kind of thing, that there was at the height?
Do you think that it's, what do you mean? It's different, you said, or what?
Well, no, like I'm just thinking, like, is there less pressure making it more
Oh,
fun
less
now?
pressure. Yeah, I guess there's probably less pressure because of that, but there's probably another pressure because it's, as most people say, it's a lot harder. The whole, you don't sell millions of records. How do you get it out there to make a living at this? But in a lot of ways, it's probably the same, because all these bands who sold millions back there, some of them, don't have the money they had like they did back then. It's still hard, even if you have a real strong name that pulls a lot of people in. It becomes a business. You got to keep making money. So there's just new ways of doing it, So maybe there's a pressure with that versus the pressure of having to sell millions of records back in the day. Now it's the pressure of having to tour enough and to get enough money and sell enough merch to keep the band afloat and moving along the way you want it to.
So I guess you have the Born to Fly video out and Beaten Odds lyric video out, and you mentioned there's four songs you're playing. Is there plans to release another lyric video or anything of that nature? Or
Yeah, well, we actually, the third video came out with the release of the album, which is Broken Hearted Daydream, and that's another performance video. It's half performance and part, Mick on his own doing some just, walking down the streets in San Francisco in the verses and stuff. So that's the other video. So we plan to do more videos. We want to try to do as many for this record as we can. Those are three songs that we're playing live. We're also playing Old Dog New Tricks and Party Time from the record, and we plan to we're probably gonna we're gonna get every song in the set at one point. We're already got like four versions of sets we can do that's gonna shuffle some of this new stuff around, and even bring some old songs in that we haven't played since the 80s.
You know, actually, you mentioned the two of those songs, Old Dogs, New Tricks, and Broken Hearted Daydreams are two of my three favorite songs in the album, along with She. I really like She.
Oh, great.
I think that's a really cool song. When you get right a great on. When you get a great lick like that, you know, what's that like? What's that? How does that feel? Does it kind of like, is there a light bulb that goes off?
On just what on the riffs of like what all
any,
those songs?
Any great about? Riff? Yeah, like all those songs. You got those great riffs.
Sometimes the light bulb goes off instantly for me, and I'm like, that's great. And then sometimes it takes me building the song a little bit and putting something behind it, or after it for it to really go, oh, okay, I know where this is going to go now. So it's a combination, but I could say like Born to Fly, instantly I knew, you know, even when I was doing the demos and I was just finishing them up by myself, I'm like, this is going to be, I knew it was going to be a special song, and it's going to be something, and it turned out the first single and the title track. So my gut was telling me something. So yeah, you know, there's a lot of times a lot of riffs do, you know, definitely the bulb goes off. So
always listen to your gut, you know. I believe that. So you also actually have a really strong ballad on this too, which is not something that usually I think of for Jet Boy. I mean, you had Too Late on Damnation and you know, mm-hmm. Hard Luck Woman from the cover of The Kiss, but it's not really something that I think of as a Jet Boy, you know. Maybe something that I imagine you were probably, you know, back in the day, the executives, that they wanted a ballad because, let's face it, that was how a lot of bands were breaking. But yeah, tell me about the ballad, The Way That You Move Me. I think it's a very strong song. I actually like it more than Too Late, so I think it's your best ballad.
That song came together. Mick had that title, and he called me. I got this title and a couple words, and just kind of like hummed an idea to me. And I said, okay, I'll work on something. And I just took that chord progression and I just played it all the way through. That whole song is one progression all the way through with other pieces building on it. It's a very much like a Free Fallin' type song, you know, and with a Stonesy, Faces Rod Stewart kind of Maggie May approach. And I, a lot of it was just sitting and arranging it and then getting a lot of these parts down, and then Fern came over and put in a couple ideas of stuff. And then, you know, we got to get a girl on this song, you know, to do a full Stonesy backing vocal thing. I love that song. That was the one song I really focused on, and we really spent a lot of time on writing and getting all that stuff in, because we just knew we wanted something like that. But it was pulling me that this is going to be a standout on this record and definitely show a huge, another side of the band in a lot of ways. Cause I love ballads. I mean, I grew up on ballads, and then Too Late was a great ballad, but we did have a ballad on Feel the Shake. But when we got dropped from Elektra, that ballad was pulled from the album, and Make Some Noise was a song we had written after we recorded Feel the Shake, and our A&R guy left and go, let's put that on the record. And this song called Missing You got bumped. And so, I don't know, I'm a ballad guy, you know, Dream On, Seasons of Wither, you know, Love to Love. I mean, all these bands from the 70s had the ultimate ballads, you know, Voices by Cheap Trick and Beth. And so, you know, ballads are great, you know.
Oh,
but
we love the ballads. I mean, absolutely.
I love them. I love them. I'm super into them. And of course, like, you know, like all the bands, I, you know, songs I mentioned, I grew up with, and Rod Stewart stuff and Stonesy stuff, but that song just kind of went that approach, and I think it came out great. It definitely is. It's a ballad, but it stands more on a Stonesy, Rod Stewarty side of a ballad, which I think is super cool.
You know, it's funny. I was listening to Seasons of Wither. I think I listened to it 5 times in a row, like 3 days ago, just over.
Oh,
I just
man,
love it.
What,
you know, so great.
Oh God, that's an amazing song.
Yeah. It's an amazing song. So obviously 28 years. The question is obvious, is you know, if this goes well, do you guys see another album in the future?
I'm a believer in never stop writing. You know, I love to write songs. Unfortunately, just sometimes my life of what I do with my guitar swallows me up a little bit where I don't have time for a few months, but I always put stuff on voice memos and doing, especially that having this guitar business and finalizing a guitar, I always just give it a few strums of type of stuff. And sometimes a lot of songs come out of that. And some of these riffs from this record came from me just like strumming something going like, I kind of like that, and voice memoing it. So I've got at least 5 voice memos of some ideas. I got 1 full song idea almost done. I just got to record them. But with me, I'll eventually sit down with Logic and I'll put a whole drum program to it and write the music and get it to mix. So, you know, he's got a couple as well that lyrically that he's already got done. So for sure, we want to do another record.
Awesome. Awesome. I can't wait then, because I imagine the 4th one will be even better.
That's right.
Yeah, I wouldn't mind us delivering a 4th record like Aerosmith Rocks or Love Gun or Dream Police, you know. So
yeah, those are pretty damn good records you just mentioned. Yeah, not bad. Not
those
bad
are,
at all.
Those are freaking iconically amazing records for me personally.
Oh, so, yeah. Oh, yeah.
If we could do something for somebody else, write a record where somebody else feels the same as I do for those records, well then, you know, accomplished.
Yeah, that would awesome. Get the next album to be thought of like your love. It's Jet Boy's Love Gun. Sweet.
Well, you know what? Actually, that is, you know, and we've taken a bunch of your time. You'd be more than generous, but that's actually a question now, because I know, like, Rocks, for instance, that Slash actually once mentioned in an interview that he was with there was some girl who was older than him, and he went to her apartment. He was like 14, she was 18, and something like, if I remember the story correctly, it was, you know, he'd been trying to get with her forever and finally had her, and she put Rocks on, and he just basically ignored her and just listened to the album. Like, it just took him, and that was where it just, you know, changed his life. So you ever have anybody walk up to you guys and say, you know, this song, this album, whatever it is, it meant a lot to me. It changed something. It changed the way I thought about something, or made me want to do something different, or anything like that.
You know, the only thing I can think of is we have this one Japanese fan, this girl by the name of Yoshikuni. She's followed us since Feel the Shake came out. And she told us years ago, I've kept up the word all these years. She still sends letters and emails and all this stuff through all these years. And we've all met her a few times. And she told me one time when I was in Japan, actually, that record saved her life, that she was like suicidal or something and depressed. And that record helped her through to get to the other side. And, you know, that's pretty freaking great. So to hear something like that, you know.
Yeah, that's really cool. Well, Billy, yeah. I mean, we, like I say, you'd be more than generous, and you'll have to do a 4th album so we have an excuse to talk to you again, because let's face it, if we had 1,000,001 questions, I think we got more than one left. But, yeah. But we won't take any more of your time tonight. It's just to give you a chance to plug the album, you know, and let everybody know where to keep up with Jet Boy and Rock and Roll Relics and things like that.
You know, everything is Jet Boy Rock. So we got the website, jetboyrocks.com, and Facebook / Jet Boy Rocks, and Instagram, Jet Boy Rocks, Twitter, YouTube. And then with my guitar company, it's rockandrollrelics.net. And it's the same with all the other ones with the, you know, Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. You could find, you know, go to the website and you can zip right over with a click to all these other social sites. And all the information will be on all the Jet Boy sites. We try to be very active right now with Instagram and Facebook, and putting out as much content as we can, not to overkill, but, you know, some throwback old stuff and new stuff and photos from current shows. And, you know, we have a TV commercial we put together for the album, which is on Instagram, which is great. It's like an old 70s commercial with a voiceover and
like a KTEL type thing.
Exactly, like a KTEL or like the Kiss commercials, you know, with that voice, and my friend did it, and it's awesome.
Awesome. Love that.
Yeah.
That's wicked. I want to go to Instagram and watch it now.
Probably will immediately after this. I can't believe I missed
it. It's cool. Yeah, it's great.
Thank you so much for your time, Billy. And I hope everybody checks out the album, checks out your work with the guitars, and we are looking forward
Yeah,
to the
that's
next
great.
time we get a chance to talk to you.
Yeah, for sure. And thank you guys and all who all do what you guys do is support rock and roll and bands that you love, and you guys put time and energy into what you do too, and that's awesome. That's how we make it all work.
Now, we're metal nerds, we'll admit it. We just love this stuff.
I'm a full metal and rock nerd. I can go down that rabbit hole deeper than most. So
Yeah.
don't get me started.
I remember 1990. I remember buying the Damnation and stuff like that. Oh yeah. I mean, we've
I
been
remember
there.
being with you when you bought it, so
That's
that's
right.
there you go.
There you go. That's awesome. Very
Well,
cool.
Billy Rowe, thank you so much. Jet Boy Born to Fly. It's the new album. Everybody should buy it, listen to it. We had a great time. Thanks a lot.
Yeah, man, that was fun. I love it.
Take a leap of faith to the unknown.